Before I get to my own words, just a couple of very brief readings. This from Geoffrey Chaucer in The Parson's Tale. Envy is the gravest sin there is, for truly all other sins are against a single virtue. Certainly envy is against all virtue and all goodness. And this from the great psychoanalyst Melanie Klein. Mental health is not compatible with shallowness. So now a question. What's the worst thing in the world? There's a lot to choose from. Hunger, greed, racism, classism, poverty, idolatry, chauvinism. I have a friend who wouldn't hesitate to say religion, which I get, but still think a bad rap, since most religions still have their virtues, don't they? Well, here's my candidate today, although I might see it differently tomorrow. It's misogyny. What the dictionary defines as dislike of, contempt for, or ingrained prejudice against women. Even if less so than a generation or two ago, I think misogyny often gets short shrift on the deplorable scale. I suspect that's because of its ingrained nature. Its very prevalence tends to give it both invisibility and deniability. It's so much a part of our lives that while we may give it cursory attention when, for example, we try to understand why two eminently more qualified candidates than our current president didn't prevail over him in a landslide, we can still easily miss the extent and depth of its reach. I think it touches us in more ways than we realize, and I think the toll it takes is immeasurable and has never been more destructive than it is right now. Recently, I've been a bit obsessed with Margaret Atwood's prescient work, The Handmaid's Tale. I imagine most of you know at least some of what it's about. A dystopian near future where almost all of America has erupted into a brutal theocracy where women are subjugated into various roles. All horrid to behold, some enough to give you nightmares. We might understand Atwood's work as a stark warning against religious fundamentalism and Christian nationalism, and we wouldn't be wrong to do so. But I think stopping there glosses over what ultimately propels its increasingly plausible vision. At its core, it's all about power, specifically male power over women. It's a fictional magnification of what I believe we already have, an entrenched way of being that countless men, as well as a surprising number of women, refuse to acknowledge, much less disfavor. It'd be hard to catalog all the ways the denigration and disempowerment of women shows up in both blatant and subtle fashion. In fact, it's so much a part of what's amiss out there, I fear many of us have become inured to its reach and impact. My contention this morning is that the dominant force fueling misogyny is a primal emotion, envy. Envy of women's capacities and prominence in all walks of life, but especially in their ability to nourish and nurture. I think envy remains entrenched among people who have insufficiently developed in ways that lead them to think critically, creatively, and respectfully of themselves and others. A distinction here. Jealousy is about coveting what you have. Envy is not only wanting what you have, but hating you for having it. Envy is what propels biting the hand that feeds you. It's an aggressive emotion. In the world of psychology, envy looms large, thanks in no small part to Sigmund Freud's signature notion of penis envy, a supposed feeling of inadequacy and jealousy that some women may experience upon realizing they don't have a penis, which Freud believed could lead to a sense of inferiority. He theorized that this envy could influence a woman's identity, relationships, and psychosocial development throughout life, a belief that's retained widespread traction, even if the theory itself has been largely discredited, at least in most psychology circles. Instead, many psychoanalysts have moved on to a growing appreciation of Freud's brilliant disciple, Emily Klein, who theorized about another kind of envy, envy of the breast, envy of the power to give or withhold nourishment, nourishment perceived by infants as the primal experience of gratification, gratification as love, the dearth of which can trigger frustration and rage. Klein posited that envy isn't merely a destructive force, but a complex signal of our unmet needs and desires. It arises from the innate human experience of longing, longing for connection, validation, and love. She found envy originating in our earliest relationships, particularly in the dynamics between infants and their caregivers. For instance, when a caregiver withholds attention, the infant may feel threatened, feeling deep-seated fears and fury at experiencing unmet needs or desires. In our current world, think of an immigrant or a person of a different color or sexuality or self-identity or a capable, powerful woman as imagined threats to a social construct that never really existed. And you can see echoes of that infantile experience of envy. Think of the many times we've all heard a prominent woman criticized for being too emotional, or for that matter, too masculine, while her male counterpart is praised for speaking from the heart. Countless double standards occur like this every day. Infants begin their first months of life in what might be called a state of healthy narcissism. I once heard John Taylor, the English Bishop of Winchester, say that newborn infants think of their mother's arms as their own creation. Within that formative ideation, they envy not only the mother's power to frustrate and withhold what they crave, but also her power to gratify their longing to be loved and nourished. Accepting that they can't do that alone can be injurious to their narcissistic sense of omnipotence. It's only through good enough development, through maturation in the loving empathy of their caregivers, that they come to internalize that the source of gratification is connected to a wider world than the reach of their arms. I know that may sound like psychobabble, but if we're to understand the envy that underlies misogyny, as well as a host of other ills out there, it's important both to know where it gets started and how it plays out in ways that affect us all deeply. Klein offers a vision where we can see envy not as a personal failure, but as a collective human experience, a shared thread in the fabric of our lives. It's not merely a destructive force, but a complex signal of the unmet needs and desires all people carry. I believe our attunement to the power of envy out there can guide us not only to become more the principled people we seek to be, but to arm ourselves to stand against the insidious impact misogyny exerts. Misogyny often serves as a projection of internal envy. Men, and sometimes women as well, who are unable to wrestle with their feelings of inadequacy and deprivation, may direct their frustrations outward, blaming women, consciously or unconsciously, for their own perceived shortfalls, thus perpetuating a cycle of envy and hostility. In figuring out how to respond to that cycle, maybe we could start by asking ourselves if any traces of misogyny, any scintilla of resentment or disdain, linger in the depths of our own unconscious mind. I suspect I'm not the only one here who can't claim to never take offense at something a woman says or does that I wouldn't mind so much if it came from a man. And if that isn't only true for me, there may be important insight for all of us. When we allow envy to fester, it can breed resentment and division. On the other hand, when we choose to respond to our feelings of envy with compassion, both for ourselves and for others, we can begin to transform these feelings into opportunities for connection and healing. By shifting our focus from envy to empathy, we not only enrich our own lives, but also strengthen the bonds of our communities. I confess I have a fuller sense of how I can transform myself or even help transform a familiar community that shares so many of my values than I do of how to transform our fellow travelers out there who seem devoted to the rubrics of misogyny and tyranny. Nevertheless, I do wonder if that wider transformation might not be essential for a nation and a world so starved of the empathy, gratitude, and generosity it lacks. And I'm pretty sure that if we're to have a meaningful role in contributing to that greater vision, the place to start is with ourselves. Maybe Shakespeare was onto something when he wrote, "The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves." So let me add a couple of closing thoughts on the transformative power of gratitude and humility. Gratitude invites us to appreciate the gifts we already possess, redirecting our attention from what we lack to what we have. When we consciously practice gratitude, we begin to reframe our relationship with envy. Instead of allowing envy to overshadow our joys, we can use it as a catalyst for appreciation, including acknowledging that the aspirations of others can coexist with our own outlooks, perhaps even to our mutual gain. Humility, in a related way, encourages us to acknowledge our own limitations and imperfections. It reminds us that everyone has their own struggles, often hidden from plain view. By embracing humility, we can foster a more compassionate perspective that allows us to empathize with the threats, real or merely imagined, that others respond to. This shift in mindset can help to build a culture of support rather than competition. When we recognize that everyone is on a unique path, we open ourselves up to deeper connections and mutual understanding. Humility invites us to learn from others, to seek inspiration and growth from the very differences that define us, and to approach life with an open heart. Instead of letting envy drive a wedge between us, we can let it be a reminder of our shared human experience and the possibility of growth through connection. May it be so.